a Chinese scholar recorded the Jurchid Khan as saying in reference to Genghis Khan. "How can we fear you?" he asked. He would soon have his answer. In the 13th century, the area south of Mongolia, now occupied by China, consisted of many independent states and kingdoms containing perhaps a third of the world population. With some 50 million people, the Jurchid Kingdom was only the second largest of the many kingdoms occupying the territory now included in modern China. The largest and most important territory was under the administration of the Song Dynasty, heir to centuries of Chinese civilization. Based in Hangzhou, and ruling some 60 million people in southern China. A string of nomadic buffer states separated the Mongolian plateau from the Song. Each buffer state, consisting of a hybrid of agricultural and grazing regions, ruled over by a former nomadic tribe that had conquered and settled among its subjects in order to more efficiently exploit them. Frequently, a new tribe emerged from the steppes to displace the older tribe that had grown weak and dissipated from several generations of soft city life. In a long-established cycle, a nomadic army swept down from the steppe, conquered the peasants and cities to the south, created a new dynasty, and after a few years, fell to the attack of another marauding tribe. Although the identities of the ruling tribe changed from century to century, the system had already been in place for thousands of years. To the west of the Jurchid were the kingdoms of the Tangut, then the Uyghur, and finally the Tian Shan Mounts, the Black Khitan. The Uyghur had already made their commitment to Genghis Khan, and in what seemed to be a practice war, he had recently subdued the Tangut. The conquest of the Tangut took place through a series of raids between 1207 and 1209. The campaign was like a thorough dress rehearsal of the coming battle against the much stronger Jurchid, complete with a crossing of the Gobi. The Tangut, a Tibetan people who had created an empire of farmers and herders along the upper reaches of the Yellow River in what is now modern Gansu province in China, occupied a weak link along the line of oases in the interior desert that controlled the flow of trade goods from the Muslim West to the Chinese East. The route stretched like thin, delicate ribbons across the deserts of the interior and provided the only links, albeit fragile ones, between the great civilizations of the East and the West. The Tangut raids had spurred Genghis Khan to learn a new type of warfare against walled cities, moats, and fortresses. Not only were the Tangut well fortified, but they had some 150,000 soldiers, nearly twice the size of the army Genghis Khan brought with him. Unlike generals who had grown up with cities and had access to centuries-old besieging techniques, Genghis Khan had to invent his own methods. He quickly learned the simple tactics, such as cutting off the Mongols' enemies from the surrounding food supply. But he soon attempted more unorthodox methods, such as when he attacked the fortified Tangut capital by diverting a channel of the Yellow River to flood it. With their inexperience in engineering, the Mongols succeeded in diverting the river, but they wiped out their own camp instead of the Tangut. Nevertheless, the Mongols survived their dangerous mistake. Genghis Khan learned from it and went on to conquer the city. In the future, the Mongols would use this method again, but each time, they would be more adept at it and use it more successfully. With Genghis Khan's decision to cross the Gobi and invade the Jurchid in 1211, he had begun not just another Chinese border war. He had lit a conflagration that would eventually consume the world. No one, not even Genghis Khan, could have seen what was coming. He showed no sign of any global ambitions, inasmuch as he fought only one war at a time. And for him, the time had come to fight the Jurchid. But starting from the Jurchid campaign, the well-trained and tightly organized Mongol army would charge out of its highland home and overrun everything from the Indus River to the Danube, from the Pacific Ocean to the Mediterranean Sea. In a flash, only 30 years, the Mongol warriors would defeat every army, capture every fort, and bring down the walls of every city they encountered. Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, and Hindus would soon kneel before the dusty boots of a literate young Mongol horseman. Crossing the vast Gobi required extensive preparation. Before the army set out, squads of soldiers went out to check the water sources and to report on grass conditions and weather. A Chinese observer remarked how the advance group scouted out every hill and every spot before the main army arrived. They wanted to know everyone in the area, every resource, and they always sought to have a ready path of retreat should it be needed. The Mongol was ideally suited to travel long distances. Each man carried precisely what he needed, but nothing more. In addition to his deal, the traditional wool robe that reached to his ankles, he wore pants, a fur hat with ear flaps, and riding boots with thick soles. In addition to clothes designed to protect him in the worst weather, each warrior carried flints for making fires, leather canteens for water and milk, files to sharpen arrowheads, a lasso for rounding up animals or prisoners, sewing needles for mending clothes, a knife and a hatchet for cutting, and a skin bag into which to pack everything. Each squad of 10 carried a small tent. The movement and formation of the Mongol army were determined by two factors that set them clearly apart from the armies of every other traditional civilization. First, the Mongol military consisted entirely of cavalry, armed riders without a marching infantry. By contrast, in virtually all other armies, the majority of the warriors would have been foot soldiers. Approximately 65,000 Mongol horsemen left on the Jurchid campaign to confront an army with about the same number of horsemen, as well as another 85,000 infantry soldiers, giving the Jurchid an advantage of well over 2-to-1, but without the mobility of the Mongol force. The second unique characteristic of the Mongol army was that it traveled without a commissary or cumbersome supply train other than its large reserve of horses that always accompanied the soldiers. As they moved, they milked the animals, slaughtered them for food, and fed themselves from hunting and looting. Marco Polo alleged that the Mongol warriors could travel 10 days without stopping to make a fire or heat food, that they drank horses' blood, and that each man carried with him 10 pounds of dried milk paste, putting 1 pound of it in a leather flask of water each day to make his meal. The warrior carried strips of dried meat and dried curd with him that he could chew while riding, and when he had fresh meat, but no time to cook it, he put the raw flesh under his saddle so it would soon be softened and edible. The Chinese noted, with surprise and disgust, the ability of the Mongol warriors to survive on little food and water for long periods. According to one, the entire army could camp without a single puff of smoke, since they needed no fires to cook. Compared to the Jurchid soldiers, the Mongols were much healthier and stronger. The Mongols consumed a steady diet of meat, milk, yogurt, and other dairy products, and they fought men who lived on gruel made from various grains. The grain diet of the peasant warriors stunted their bones, rotted their teeth, and left them weak and prone to disease. In contrast, the poorest Mongol soldier ate mostly protein, thereby giving him strong teeth and bones. Unlike the Jurchid soldiers, who were dependent on a heavy carbohydrate diet, the Mongols could more easily go a day or two without food. Traditional armies moved in long columns of men marching the same route with their large supplies of food following them. By contrast, the Mongol army spread out over a vast area to provide sufficient pasture for the animals and to maximize hunting opportunities for the soldiers. Genghis Khan moved at the center, flanked by the army of the right to the west and the army of the left to the east. A smaller unit took positions as advance guard and another as guard of the rear, where the Mongols also carried the reserve animals. The decimal organization of Genghis Khan's army made it highly mutable and mobile. Each unit of 10,000 functioned like a miniature version of Genghis Khan's camp. The commander of 10,000 moved at the center of his unit of 1,000, and he stationed the other 9 units around him, to the left, the right, the back, and the front, as needed. Rather than a hierarchy of military units, Genghis Khan organized his men into a set of concentric circles. Although the Mongols moved their military camps frequently, the central camp for each unit was laid out in a precise pattern so that newly arriving soldiers always knew where to report and how to find whatever they needed. Each Mongol unit of 1,000 traveled with its own medical unit, usually composed of Chinese doctors to care for the sick and wounded. The tents were lined up in specific formations, each formation with its name and purpose, and even the insides of the tents were arranged in precisely the same way. After a day of travel, fighting, or hunting, the army camped with the officers at the center of the camp, surrounded by guards and other soldiers. At night, horses were kept ready in case they might be needed, and a perimeter was set up at the edge of the camp. By contrast to the well-structured and neatly organized center of the camp, most of the common warriors broke up into their small bands and spread out over the countryside to camp at night. At dusk, they made small fires, preferably when it was too light for the fire to show up clearly at a distance, yet too dark for the smoke to be seen from very far away. With the fire, they quickly prepared their only hot meal of the day. After eating, they did not linger or sleep by the fire. They dispersed into yet smaller groups of 3 to 5 men, who slept in hidden recesses spread throughout the area. As soon as daylight broke the next morning, they began the day with a careful reconnaissance of the right, the left, the back, and the front. With his men spread out over such a large area, communications became more important yet more difficult. Conventional armies moved and camped in massive columns, and the commanders could easily communicate with one another through written messages. For the Mongols, the troops were more spread out, and even the officers were illiterate. All communication at every level had to be oral, not written. Orders moved by word of mouth from man to man. The problem with an oral system of communication lay in the accuracy of the message. The message had to be repeated precisely each time to each person and then remembered exactly as spoken. To ensure accurate memorization, the officers composed their orders in rhyme, using a standardized system known to every soldier. The Mongol warriors used a set of fixed melodies and poetic styles into which various words could be improvised according to the meaning of the message. For a soldier, hearing the message was like learning a new verse to a song that he already knew. The soldiers, like bands of riders on the steppe still do today, frequently sang as they rode in their small groups. In addition to singing about what soldiers always sing about, home, women, and fighting, the Mongol soldiers sang their laws and rules of conduct, which had also been set to music, so that every man might know them. By memorizing the laws and constantly practicing the format of their message songs, every man was ready, at any moment's notice, to learn a new message in the form of a new verse to these well-rehearsed songs and take it where ordered. Despite the disadvantages of fighting on alien land, outnumbered by enemies, Genghis Khan had the advantage of lessons learned from a lifetime of warfare, and he knew his troops and his officers intimately. He had fought with many of them for more than a quarter of a century and a few of the generals, such as Borch and Jelm, had been with him for nearly 40 years. He knew that he could trust them on long campaigns far away from his oversight. He also understood each general's strengths and weaknesses. Jeb, one of his commanders, would fight fast and furiously, taking unusual chances and inspiring resolute courage among his men in battle. While Muhal, another commander, moved slowly and methodically, but could sustain longer and broader assignments. The Mongols, no matter how rigorous their training, how precise their discipline, or how determined their will, could not conquer fortified cities by conventional warfare. In facing the Djurchid, Genghis Khan employed the basic strategy of his earlier steppe wars by trying to win the battle before the first arrow was shot across the battlefield, to defeat the enemy by first creating confusion and then instilling fear to break his spirit. Because the Mongols initially lacked the weapons or knowledge to break down the massive city walls, they wreaked havoc in the surrounding countryside and then disappeared, only to reappear again just when it seemed that the city was safe. Genghis Khan sought to further undermine his enemies by exploiting any internal social turmoil or rift he could identify. In the Djurchid campaign, his first effort was to divide the Khitan from their Djurchid rulers while breaking the confidence that the Chinese subjects had that the Djurchid could defend them. In a masterful propaganda campaign, the Mongols entered Djurchid territory, announcing themselves as a liberating force, intent on restoring the older Khitan royal family that had ruled before the Djurchid overthrew them a century earlier. Before the fighting began, many Khitan fled to join the Mongols, whom they saw as relatives speaking the same language. In one of the first actions of the war, Jeb, accompanied by Genghis Khan's brother Khasar, led a Mongol army straight for the Khitan homeland along the Liao River. The Mongol soldiers found enthusiastic support from the Khitan, and they quickly located a descendant of the Yelu dynasty, the former Khitan royal family. The following year, 1212, Genghis Khan officially restored the Khitan monarchy as a vassal state within the Mongol Empire. Of course, the Mongols had not yet conquered all the Djurchid lands, but by creating the vassal state, he managed to further divide the Djurchid and attract more deserters to the Mongol side. Throughout his campaign, he found members of the old Khitan aristocracy anxious to help him understand the land he had invaded. One of the most important would be Yelu Chuke, a young man in his 20s from the royal family of the Khitan. He attracted Mongol attention because of his training in astrology and the esoteric art of scapulomancy, divining the future by reading the cracks in the heated shoulder blade of a sacrificed sheep or goat. Because he was a native Khitan and spoke that language, he could easily communicate with the Mongols, but he also had extensive knowledge of Chinese culture. With their understanding of the Mongolian and Chinese languages, as well as their skill in writing and knowledge of law and tradition among the settled populace, the Khitan scholars proved so useful in administering the Mongol Empire that Genghis Khan concentrated more attention on attracting or capturing scholars of all sorts in an effort to apply their knowledge to benefit the empire. Thereafter, everywhere he went, he had such men brought to him for interrogation, to see what skill they might have and where in his empire it might be applied. The Mongol way of fighting was a refinement of the traditional steppe system that had been developed in Mongolia over many thousands of years. Superior weapons in the end did not account for the Mongol success. Weapon technology does not remain secret for long, and whatever works for one side can be readily adopted for use by the enemy after just a few battles. The Mongols' success arose from their cohesion and discipline, bred over millennia as nomads working in small groups, and from their steadfast loyalty to their leader. Warriors everywhere have been taught to die for their leader. But Genghis Khan never asked his men to die for him. Above all else, he waged war with this strategic purpose in mind: to preserve Mongol life. Unlike other generals and emperors in history, who easily ordered hundreds of thousands of soldiers to their death, Genghis Khan would never willingly sacrifice a single one. The most important rules that he created for his army concerned the loss of soldiers. On and off the battlefield, the Mongol warrior was forbidden to speak of death, injury, or defeat. Just to think of it might make it happen. Even mentioning the name of a fallen comrade or other dead warrior constituted a serious taboo. Every Mongol soldier had to live his life as a warrior with the assumption that he was immortal, that no one could defeat him or harm him, that nothing could kill him. At the last moment of life, when all had failed and no hope remained, the Mongol warrior was supposed to look upward and beckon his fate by calling out the name of the eternal blue sky as his final earthly words. In fighting on the steppe, the nomads left the corpses of fallen soldiers and their possessions on the field to be disposed of by animals and to decompose naturally. In the cultivated lands far from home, the Mongols feared that the body would not be allowed a natural decomposition and that local people might desecrate it. In another change from the normal pattern for steppe battles during the Jurchid campaign, the Mongols began sending home the dead warriors for internment on the steppe. War captives transported the dead bodies by some means, probably sewing them in leather bags, put on camels, or in carts drawn by oxen. On the few occasions when this proved impossible, the Mongols had the bodies taken to a grassy area nearby and secretly buried each man with all of his belongings. They then drove animals over the grave to obscure it and prevent the peasants from finding it and exhuming the possessions. The Mongols did not find honor in fighting. They found honor in winning. They had a single goal in every campaign: total victory. Toward this end, it did not matter what tactics were used against the enemy or how the battles were fought or avoided being fought. Winning by clever deception or cruel trickery was still winning and carried no stain on the bravery of the warriors, since there would be plenty of other occasions for showing prowess on the field. For the Mongol warrior, there was no such thing as individual honor in battle if the battle was lost. As Genghis Khan reportedly said, "There is no good in anything until it is finished." Nowhere did Mongol ingenuity show itself more clearly than in their ability to transform the Jurchid's greatest asset, their large population, into their greatest liability. Before attacking a city, the Mongols typically cleared out all the surrounding villages. They forcefully conscripted the local labor through an extension of their decimal organization of the military. Each Mongol warrior had to round up 10 local men to work under his command. If any of them died, he had to replace the worker, so that he always had 10 men at his disposal. As an extension of the army, these captives performed the daily tasks of getting food and water for the animals and soldiers, as well as gathering needed material, such as stones and dirt, to fill in the moat in the upcoming siege. These conscripted men would also maneuver and operate the siege engines that pounded the walls with wooden or stone missiles and would push the movable towers built to breach the city walls. For the Mongols, the lifestyle of the peasant seemed incomprehensible. The Jurchid territory was filled with so many people and yet so few animals. This was a stark contrast to Mongolia, where there were normally 5 to 10 animals for each human. To the Mongols, The farmers' fields were just grasslands, as were the gardens, and the peasants were like grazing animals, rather than real humans who ate meat. The Mongols referred to these grass-eating people with the same terminology that they used for cows and goats. The masses of peasants were just so many herds, and when the soldiers went out to round up their people or to drive them away, they did so with the same terminology, precision and emotion, used in rounding up yaks. Traditional armies of the era treated villages as resources to be looted, and the peasants as a nuisance to be raped, killed, or disposed of in any convenient way. By contrast, the Mongols, who were always low in numbers compared with the place they invaded, put the massive number of people to strategic uses. The Mongol warriors modified the traditional steppe strategy of rounding up the enemy's herds and stampeding them toward their owners' battle lines or homes, thereby creating great confusion before the soldiers raced in to attack. In the Jurchid campaign, the Mongols adapted this tactic to the herds of the peasant farmers. The Mongol army divided into small units that attacked undefended villages, set them afire, and chased out the residents. The frightened peasants fled in all directions. They clogged the highways and made it difficult for the Jurchid supply convoys to move. In the Jurchid campaign, more than 1 million refugees fled the countryside in desperation and poured into the cities. They ate up huge stores of food and caused chaos wherever they went. Instead of being followed by mobs of refugees, as was typical for the armies of the time, the Mongols were preceded by them, and the Mongols also used the displaced peasants in a more direct way, as shields and as living battering rams against the city gates. The Mongols showed little concern for the loss of enemy life, so long as it preserved Mongol life. As the captives fell in battle, their bodies helped to fill in the moats and form pathways over defensive holes and structures made by the enemies. Trapped inside their cities, the Jurchid and their subjects starved, and in one city after another, they resorted to cannibalism. Discontent grew, and urban mutinies and peasant rebellions broke out against the Jurchid officials, who proved unable to protect, feed, or manage the massive numbers of refugees. In the worst such rebellion, the Jurchid army ended up killing some 30,000 of their own peasants. In contrast to the massive infantry armies that moved slowly and fought along a particular front or on a specific battlefield, the Mongols practiced warfare across the entire territory, and the ensuing turmoil and confusion allowed the Mongols to employ clever trickery of all sorts. In one episode, the Mongols captured a convoy with a high-ranking official en route to relieve the besieged city of Dading. One of the Mongols, dressed in the envoy's clothes, took his official papers and proceeded to the enemy city in disguise. As he arrived, by prearrangement, the Mongol army lifted its siege and departed. Once inside the city, the Mongol pretender fooled the local officials into believing that they had just defeated the Mongols. The pretender then oversaw the painstaking dismantling of the city's defenses and the withdrawal of troops. After several weeks of disarmament, he sent word to the Mongols, who returned like lightning and easily took the city. The Mongols not only took advantage of such trickery, but in their relentless use of propaganda, they spread stories to foment anxiety and fear among the enemy. In one apocryphal account circulated to create anxiety among the enemy, the Mongols supposedly promised to retreat from a besieged city if the Jurchid defenders would give them a large number of cats and birds as booty. According to the story, the starving residents eagerly gathered the animals and gave them to the Mongols. After receiving all the birds and animals, the Mongols attached burning torches and banners to their tails and released them, whereupon the frightened animals raced back into the city and set it on fire. The story supplied a dramatic dose of war propaganda. After all the reconnaissance, organization, and propaganda, when the attack finally came, the Mongol army sought to create as much confusion and havoc for the enemy as possible. One of the most common forms of attack, similar to the bush formation, was the crow swarm or falling stars attack. At the signal of a drum or by fire at night, the horsemen came galloping from all directions at once. In the words of a Chinese observer of the time, "They come as though the sky were falling, and they disappear like the flash of lightning." The enemy was shaken and unnerved by the sudden assault and equally sudden disappearance. The roaring wave of noise followed by a greater silence. Before they could respond properly to the attack, the Mongols were gone and left the enemy bleeding and confused. Beginning with the Tangut campaigns, Genghis Khan had discovered that Chinese engineers knew how to build siege machines that could batter city walls with massive stones from far away. The Chinese had already developed a number of those devices. The catapult hurled stones, flaming liquids, and other harmful substances at or across city walls, and the trebuchet, a catapult powered by the drop of a heavy counterweight, threw objects even faster than the torsion catapult. The ballista was a mechanical device that shot large arrows that could damage buildings and structures and kill any person or animal in its path. Although quite old in the military history of siege warfare, the weapons were new to the Mongols, but they soon became a permanent part of the arsenal of Genghis Khan, who appreciated the efficiency and ingenuity behind them. More than merely using the weapons, Genghis Khan acquired the engineering intelligence needed to create them. The Mongols eagerly rewarded engineers who defected to them, and after each battle, carefully selected engineers from among the captives and impressed them into Mongol service. Genghis Khan made engineering units a permanent part of the Mongol army. And with each new battle and each conquest, his war machinery grew in complexity and efficiency. The siege engines exercised a particular fascination for the Mongols because they allowed the attackers to stay well outside of the city and away from the danger of the person-to-person combat that they so abhorred. At some point, the Mongols encountered the Jurchid use of the fire lance, a bamboo tube stuffed with gunpowder, which when lit, produced a slow burn that spewed sparks, flames, and smoke out of the end of the tube like a flamethrower. Developed from firecrackers, this weapon was used to ignite fires and as a device to disorient the enemy and their horses. In later refinements, the Mongols would adapt it for many more military purposes. When he could not overtake their fortifications, Genghis Khan tried to draw the enemy out from their stronghold through stratagems such as pretending to retreat, as illustrated in Jeb's siege of Liaoyang during the Jurchid campaign. In a movement known as the dogfight tactic, he feigned a withdrawal, ordering his troops to leave behind a lot of their equipment and stores as though they had fled in great fearful haste. The city officials sent soldiers out to gather up the booty, and they quickly clogged the open gates with carts and animals transporting all the goods. With the soldiers on the open field and the city gates opened, the Mongols fell upon them and raced through the open doors to capture the city. As lifelong nomads, the Mongols learned early to fight on the move. For the soldier farmer, to flee meant to lose, to chase meant to win. The sedentary soldiers sought to drive the attacker away from the place. The nomad sought to kill the enemy, and it mattered not at all whether he killed the enemy while attacking toward him or fleeing from him. For the Mongol, both directions represented fighting. A fleeing conquest was just as good as a stationary one. Once Mongols lured their opponents out of their walled cities, they applied the techniques they had learned for managing the movement of large groups of animals. Most commonly, they either strung their pursuers out in a long line that became increasingly defenseless and was easily attacked as soon as the Mongols had lured them into a trap, or the fleeing Mongols divided into their small squads and led their pursuers off in small groups that could be more easily overcome. Even when routed or pursued by a determined enemy, the Mongols employed still more tricks with which to save themselves. If they were surprised and overtaken while on patrol, they usually carried some valuable items with them to strew on the ground as they escaped. The enemy invariably broke ranks to retrieve the goods, often fighting among themselves to do so, and thereby allowed the Mongols to escape. At other times, the Mongols threw sand in the wind, or tied tree branches to their horses' tails, to whip up the dust in order to obscure their movements, or to make the pursuers think that the Mongols were in much greater numbers than they actually were. After the first year of the Jurchid campaigns, it became clear that the worst danger for the Mongols derived not from battle, but from the unpleasant climate. The lower altitude and closeness to great rivers and the ocean made the air hold its moisture, and in the summer, the heat and humidity became nearly unbearable for the Mongols and their shaggy horses. Repeatedly, they reported falling ill, with a horrible variety of maladies, when in the agricultural and urban areas. Campaigning nearly halted in the summer, when large numbers of the Mongols and their horse herds withdrew the relatively short distance to the higher and cooler grasslands of Inner Mongolia. In 1214, Genghis Khan at last besieged the court of the Golden Khan himself in Zhangdu, Beijing. The court had just been through a palace coup, and the new Golden Khan had endured so much internal strife that rather than face a prolonged siege and war, he agreed to a settlement with the Mongols to make them withdraw. He gave them massive amounts of silk, silver, and gold, as well as 3,000 horses and 500 young men and women. To seal the arrangement, the Golden Khan recognized himself as a vassal of Genghis Khan and gave him one of his royal princesses as a wife. In response, Genghis Khan broke his siege of Zhangdu and began the long trek back toward Outer Mongolia on the north side of the Gobi. The Khitan had received back much of their land, and their royal family had been restored. The Jurchid would be allowed to keep a smaller kingdom for themselves. He evidenced no intention of ruling these areas or setting up a Mongol government so long as he could get the goods he wanted. Just as he had left the Uyghur and the Tangut in charge of their own lands, he was glad to leave the Jurchid and the Khitan to administer their kingdom in whatever way they saw fit, so long as they remained subservient to the Mongols and supplied them with tribute. Since both the Khitan and the Jurchid acknowledged Genghis Khan as the supreme emperor over all of them, he had no further reason to stay in their lands. The summer was just beginning, but already the heat and dryness prevented his army crossing the Gobi back toward home. Instead, they made camp on the south side of the Gobi at a place called Dolon Nur, Seven Lakes. As they awaited the cooler days of autumn, the troops could enjoy games, feasting, and the talents of the musicians and singers whom they had captured and were taking home with them. As soon as the Mongols withdrew from the newly conquered territory, however, the Jurchid authorities began to renege on their agreement. Mistrusting his own subjects, whom he suspected of secretly siding with the Mongol invaders, the Golden Khan, whom Genghis Khan had left on the throne, evacuated his capital at Zhangdu, and the entire court fled south to Kaifeng, where they thought they would be well beyond the ability of the Mongol army to penetrate. For Genghis Khan, the flight of the Golden Khan was an act of betrayal of their new alliance, and he considered it rebellion. Although he had been away from his homeland between the Onon and Harlan rivers for more than 3 years, Genghis Khan prepared to return to fight again. He organized his army for a fourth year of fighting, marched down from Inner Mongolia, and headed back toward the capital that had surrendered to him and his army only a few months previously. The Golden Khan had left a contingent of soldiers to guard the old capital city, but the soldiers and the people knew that they had been deserted. Genghis Khan's victories in the previous year's campaign inspired a mounting wave of support from within the enemy ranks, particularly those abandoned by the Golden Khan. In the traditional Chinese view, victory in war came to those whom heaven favored. And with an increasingly long list of victories to his credit, it became apparent to Chinese peasants and Jurchid warriors alike that Genghis Khan fought under the clear mandate of heaven, and to fight against him risks offending heaven itself. Many Jurchid and other tribal soldiers in the service of the Golden Khan also discerned in Genghis Khan a true steppe warrior, like their own ancestors were, prior to conquering and settling in cities. They had more in common with him and his soldiers than with the effete and debauched rulers who had, in any event, abandoned them to their fate against the invaders. Entire regiments, with their officers and weapons, deserted to join the Mongol forces. Genghis Khan and his newly incorporated allies easily took the city. This time, however, he presented no opportunity for the defeated Jurchid to submit tribute. The city would be punished and looted. The Mongols would take everything. Once it became clear that the city would soon fall, Genghis Khan turned over the final assault to his subordinates. Irritated by the increasing summer heat and disgusted by the filth of sedentary life, Genghis Khan left Zhongdu to return to the higher, drier, and more open lands of Inner Mongolia. He delegated the looting of the city to Had, a Khitan commander, and his troops, since they were more accustomed to managing cities and would know best how to extract the wealth. Mongol officials would wait outside the city some distance away for the loot to be brought to them and recorded. Genghis Khan expected the sacking to be executed in the usual and efficient Mongol manner that he had insisted upon since the defeat of the Tatars. In the Mongol way, soldiers treated the collection of loot as they did the harvesting of animals on the group hunt, distributing it among all the Mongols according to their rank, down to the last brass button or final grain of silver. All of it was allocated according to a precise formula, from the 10% for the Khan to the specified share for orphans and widows. The new Mongol allies, however, either did not understand the system or simply refused to abide by it. Many of them, particularly the Khitan and the Chinese, who had suffered great repression and had many complaints against the Jurchid, lusted after revenge and destruction. They felt that each soldier had the right to keep what he seized. They stripped gold from the walls of palaces, pried precious stones out of their settings, and seized chests filled with gold and silver coins. They loaded the precious metals into ox carts and tied bundles of silk on their camels' backs. Genghis Khan considered plunder to be an important matter of state, and as such, he sent the chief Mongol judge, Shig Hutuch, to the city to oversee the methodical looting and compile a meticulous inventory. Instead of an orderly process, Shig Hutuch encountered chaos. Mongol officials outside the city, including the royal cook, had accepted silk embroidered with gold as bribes to allow the chaotic looting by the Allied soldiers to continue. And when Shig-Hutuk arrived, he too was offered a personal share of the goods. He refused and returned to Genghis Khan to report the misconduct. Genghis Khan became angry, rebuked the Hitan, and confiscated the goods. But no record of the punishment survives. As the Mongol warriors withdrew from the cities of the Jurchid, they had one final punishment to inflict upon the land where they had already driven out the people and burned their villages. Genghis Khan wanted to leave a large open land with ample pastures should his army need to return. The plowed fields, stone walls, and deep ditches had slowed the Mongol horses and hindered their ability to move across the landscape in any direction they wished. The same things also prevented the free migration of the herds of antelope, asses, and other wild animals that the Mongols enjoyed hunting. When the Mongols left from their Jurchid campaign, they churned up the land behind them by having their horses trample the farmland with their hooves and prepare it to return to open pasture. They wanted to ensure that the peasants never returned to their villages and fields. In this way, Inner Mongolia remained a grazing land, and the Mongols created a large buffer zone of pastures and forests between the tribal lands and the fields of the sedentary farmers. The grassy steppes served as ready stores of pasturage for their horses that allowed them easier access in future raids and campaigns, and they provided a ready store of meat in the herds of wild animals that returned once the farmers and villagers had been expelled. Through the first half of 1215, the year of the pig, the Mongols slowly set out with caravans of people, animals, and goods from the smoldering ruins of Zhongdu to the high arid plateau of Inner Mongolia. They gathered again at Dolan Nor, where Genghis Khan had waited unsuccessfully to cross back home 1 year earlier, and they waited for the summer to pass before venturing across the Gobi. Genghis Khan had once again shown his ability to win in war, and now he demonstrated, on a scale unprecedented in the history of steppe khans, his ability to bring the goods home to his people. A river of brightly colored silk flowed out of China. It was as though Genghis Khan had rerouted all the different twisting channels of the Silk Route, combined them into one large stream, and redirected it northward to spill out across the Mongol steppes. The caravans of camels and ox carts carried so much of the precious cloth that the Mongols used silk to wrap their other goods and as packing material. They threw away their rawhide ropes and used twisted cords of silk instead. They bundled robes embroidered with silver and golden thread in the designs of blooming peonies, flying cranes, breaking waves, and mythical beasts. And they packed silk slippers sewn with tiny pearls. The Mongols filled carts with silk rugs, wall hangings, pillows, cushions, and blankets, as well as silk sashes, braid, fringe, and tassels. They carried bolts of raw silk, silken threads, and cloth worked into every imaginable type of clothing or decorations, and in more colors than the Mongol language could identify. In addition to silk, satin, brocade, and gauze, the bundles contained whatever objects the Mongol eye fancied and could be moved, including lacquered furniture, paper fans, porcelain bowls, metal armor, bronze knives, wooden puppets, iron kettles, brass pots, board games, and carved saddles. The Mongols carried jugs of perfume and makeup made from ochre, yellow lead, indigo, flower extracts, fragrant waxes, balsam, and musk. They brought hair ornaments and jewelry crafted from precious metals, ivory or tortoiseshell, and studded with turquoise, pearls, cornelian, coral, lapis lazuli, emeralds, and diamonds. Wagons loaded with skins of wine, casks of honey and bricks of black tea, followed camels that smelled of incense, medicines, aphrodisiacs, and special woods of cinnabar, camphor, and sandalwood. Long lines of clerks laboriously catalogued, checked, and rechecked the goods of each caravan of camels and ox carts. Musicians played and sang to delight their captors as the caravan moved. Whenever the caravan paused, acrobats, contortionists, and jugglers performed, while young girls gathered dried dung for the fire, milked the animals, cooked a meal, and offered whatever else might be asked of them. Boys tended the animals and lifted the heavy loads. Behind the animals came the endless lines of marching captives, thousands upon thousands. Princes and priests, tailors and pharmacists, translators and scribes, astrologers and jewelers, artists and soothsayers, magicians and goldsmiths. Anyone evidencing a skill had been rounded up, together with those who merely attracted the attention of one of the Mongols for whatever reason or fancy. In all the centuries of raiding and trading, no leader had brought back to his homeland nearly the amount of goods as Genghis Khan. But vast as the quantities were, the appetites of his own people were insatiable. As he returned from his campaigns, his caravans were laden with valuable goods, but each load created the desire for yet more. Every Mongol could sit in his gur on lacquered furniture draped in silk. Every maiden was perfumed, painted with makeup and bejeweled. Every riding horse was fixed with metal fittings, and every warrior with bronze and iron weapons, to work their crafts. The thousands of new craftsmen needed more raw materials, everything from wood, clay, and cloth to bronze, gold, and silver. To feed these workers, constant supplies of barley, wheat, and other food commodities had to be hauled across the vast wasteland, separating the herders' pastures and the agricultural fields of the south. And the more captives Genghis Khan brought home, the more food and equipment he had to obtain to supply them. Novelties became necessities, and each caravan of cargo stimulated a craving for more. The more he conquered, the more he had to conquer. The steppes could no longer be isolated. Genghis Khan had to organize supply lines, maintain production, and coordinate the movement of goods and people on an unprecedented scale. What began as a quick raid on cities south of the Gobi for silks and baubles had turned into 3 decades of the most extensive war in world history. Genghis Khan would spend the next 15 years of his life fighting across the face of Asia. And at his death, he bequeathed the war to his descendants to expand into new countries and against new people for 2 more generations. After the Jurchid campaigns, the great Khan returned directly to his steppes of Hodoy Aral between the Herlin and the Senkar rivers. In keeping with his prior practices, Genghis Khan immediately began to distribute the accumulated booty to his generals and officers, who in turn made the appropriate divisions among their own men. For the first time in his career, however, he simply had too much loot and material to distribute, and he needed to find ways to administer it and store it until needed. To solve this problem of affluence, Genghis Khan allowed the construction of some buildings. He situated them near the small Abraga stream, somewhat to the side of the steppe, where a spring bubbled up out of the ground. According to tradition, Bort treated her young son Ogade with the water from the spring in order to cure disease. Collectively, the buildings were named the Yellow Palace, and they served mostly as warehouses for the goods brought back from the campaigns. With rivers on both sides, and a small clump of hills in the middle. The area was easily protected, and made a surprise attack virtually impossible. After his long absence, Genghis Khan had many pending problems to solve, not only among his Mongol subjects, but also with the Siberian tribes of the north and the Uyghur farmers of the south. Some of the Siberian tribes that had first submitted to Mongol rule during Jurchid's invasion of 1207 used Genghis Khan's lengthy absence on the Jurchid campaign to quit sending tributary furs, forest products, and young women. When a Mongol envoy arrived to investigate, however, he found that in keeping with the fame of their women, they now had a woman chief, whom they called Botohu Tarhun, a name that meant roughly big and fierce. Rather than surrender 30 maidens to the Mongols as wives, she took the Mongol himself captive. When the messenger did not return, Genghis Khan eventually sent another negotiator, and she took him captive as well. In 1219, the year of the hare, Genghis Khan sent a trusted general with a detachment of good soldiers to find out what had happened. Accustomed to campaigning on the open steppes and in the farmlands, the Mongols had little experience fighting or traveling in the dense forest. Usually, the Mongols crossed the steppe by spreading out and moving forward on a broad front. In the forest, however, they had to follow one another along the narrow trails. Botohu Tarhun's forces heard them coming long before they arrived in her territory. And like any experienced forest hunter, she set a trap for them. She sent a contingent of her troops to seal off the trail behind the men to prevent their escape. Then she ambushed them from the front. Botohu Tarhun's forces triumphed, and in the battle, her warriors killed the Mongol general. Such a loss was highly unusual, and it enraged Genghis Khan. At first, he threatened to lead the army himself in vengeance against the victorious queen. His advisors soon convinced him otherwise. They prepared a large expedition, and this time the Mongols were determined to win by whatever means necessary. A small detachment of Mongol warriors moved out as a decoy, pretending to guard the frontier trail and passes between the Mongols and the queen's territory. Meanwhile, the Mongol soldiers in the main force of the army secretly cut a new road through the forest from another direction. With axes, adzes, saws, chisels, and all the tools and weapons they could muster, the Mongols laboriously cleared a path by following the mountain trail of the Red Bull, probably the large reddish deer or elk. After completing the secret road, the Mongol soldiers swooped down on the queen's headquarters so fast that, in the words of the secret history, it seemed as though they had descended through the top of the smoke holes of their tents. The victorious Mongols freed their envoys and brought back the tribe as prisoners, to be divided up as servants and mates. Genghis Khan gave the queen, Botohu Tarhun, in marriage to the second of the envoys, whom she may have already taken as her husband, since she had kept him as her prisoner and had not killed him. The forest tribes provided only a brief distraction for Genghis Khan, compared to the more serious issues among the Uyghurs of the desert oases, who ranked among his most steadfast subjects. They supported him so strongly that other Muslim Uyghurs, living further to the west in the foothills of the Tian Shan Mountains of what is modern-day Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, wished to overthrow their Buddhist rulers and join Genghis Khan as well. Envoys came to the Mongol country from the Muslim people of Kashgar, a trading city in what is now the province of Xinjiang in western China. At the beginning of the 13th century, These people were ruled by another group of Hitan that originated in Manchuria. But they had been driven out of the east by the Jurchid and settled in the Tian Shan Mountains. To differentiate